quite different. But this is Flat and Scruggs at Carnegie Hall. This is a classic track, and when we bought the album and put it on, this was the first thing that we heard.
A great big hole in the bottom of my shoe.
Let me be your sword dog. Let me be your sword dog, or I'm gonna be your man at all. Let me be your sword dog.
Look here, Sal, I know you run down stocking and a woe out you.
Let me be your solid dog. Let me be your solid dog, or I won't be your man at all. Let me be your solid dog.
Setting on a log, finger on trigger, now on the hog.
Let me be your solid dog. Let me be your solid dog, or I won't be your man at all. Let me be your solid dog.
Trigger and the gun said go, shot fell over in Mexico.
Let me be your solid dog. Let me be your solid dog, or I won't be your man at all. Let me be your solid dog.
They get an amazing
awesome
sound.
Awesome for live, yeah, it's so good.
You see pictures of them on stage, and they just had two microphones,
yeah.
You know, and I think they probably would have put a mic on the bass or something like that, but he was one of the singers, and they move in and out, and, you know, this, and it's a totally different thing. So I guess your challenge as an engineer is to capture a sound that someone's got in their head, you know, and if it's someone like you and you're a guitarist when you sing, you're probably listening for a pretty driving guitar behind your voice, because that's how you imagine your sound.
Yeah.
I'm saying that very carefully, but
I know what you mean. Yeah.
But that's how you imagine your sound with so it's going to be a guitar-driven sound, and Dan Tominski was a bit like that. But there's others who would, they're just playing guitar just to pitch to, really, and just to do something while they're singing, and they let the others push the band along, you know, and there's so many different approaches. Do you get the music down for someone like I did? I came in and recorded my track, and it rolled along, was a sort of mid-tempo-y, bluegrassy country sort of sound. Did that, then do you experiment with mixes? Do you say it needs more punch in the guitar, or needs less guitar, or needs more bass, or
Definitely, and every instrument I record, just sort of you might remix another, because something will sit differently when there's something new in there. So along the way, you're always remixing every instrument, I find. You can't just mix the drums at the start and be like, yep, that'll do for the rest of the song.
Right.
So everything you add, because it's adding a new element and new frequencies, they'll behave differently with everything else. So you're constantly remixing the song as a whole. And always trying to mix with everything on. That's what I try to do.
Oh, right.
Because if you mix too much in solo, what we call, and you just solo the one instrument, it's not how it's going to sound, obviously, when it's everyone's in. So I try to mix with everything in as much as I can.
What do you do about reverbs? Do you put reverb on each instrument as you're recording it, or do you wait until you've got a complete sound before you do reverbs and things?
No, I do reverbs as I go with each instrument, but like I said before, that could change too. So I usually have a reverb channel for certain instrument groups, like I'll have an acoustic reverb channel,
yes,
where it's just like a, I might have a plate reverb or a room reverb for certain reverb for the guitars, and they'll all send to that same reverb, so they all sound like they're in the same space.
Yeah.
And then vocals will usually have a different type of reverb, like a plate.
Yeah, reverbs were handled very badly in the 1950s for bluegrass bands, particularly in the many recordings sounded like they were recorded in an outside toilet or something like that, you know, just with all hard surfaces and just sounded dreadful, you know. That's why the bluegrass album band was great, because all these old recordings that we'd listened to that were of varying standards of recording were not up to what our ears were used to. So they just basically put everything into something that was very listenable.
Yeah. And back in the day, it was all real reverbs too. When you, like you mentioned, your friend had, he bought the reverb, the real reverb.
Yeah.
And now it's all digital, but back then it was sort of like, once you've printed that on there, it's, you know, your reverb's there. You can't go back and tweak it along the way.
Oh, is that right?
Because back then you'd send your track through a reverb tank or a reverb plate, a real one, and once you've recorded that, that's there. You can't go back and tweak one parameter of the reverb.
Yeah.
Well, nowadays with plugins, you know, you go in and just make the room a little bigger, a little smaller. Or
you're playing. Now, I'm getting on in years and have deafness and sore fingers and things like that. Mm. So when I go into a session like you wanted yesterday, I'm thinking, God, I hope I can play this, you know. And by the time we'd run through the tune 10 times, I'd sort of got the hang of it and could do it. What do you do when a musician isn't quite coming up to what you want for the track?
I really haven't had that yet. I like to think that I know the person's abilities once I get them in. I know they can do the spot. And, you know, even if someone comes in and I've had new people come in and they think, oh, you know, I don't think I can do this. Or I had a singer once that said, oh, I don't think I can hit these highs. We can might have to cancel this. Yes. I said, no, come in. I know what you can do and I know I can get it out of you.
Okay.
And we did. It did.
Right.
In the studio. And so, yeah, I think it's just... And that's part of my job as well as a producer, is also just getting the best out of an artist and out of a musician.
Mm.
But yeah, I haven't really had that problem with a musician coming in and not be able to do the job. Yeah.
You always wonder. I mean, I've done quite a few sessions, but not a huge number. I've done quite a few sessions, often as overdubbing, and if I was playing with the band, I wouldn't have any concerns.
Oh, right.
But when I'm overdubbing, you do. Even though you've got the sound in your headphones and the sound of your banjo and everything's there, it just feels different.
Yeah.
But I know that if I was recording it live with the band, I'd be good. I'd be in time and mostly get the chord changes and only bluff, make a mess every now and then, you know, like yesterday.
Yeah. I also think when you're overdubbing and you're the only instrument in there and you're the loudest, and I think you tend to think that everything has to be exactly perfect, when in reality, when you're in a mix like that, we're not robots. we're humans, and it sounds good like that.
Yes.
You know, and those little things that make it human make it sound good compared to if you brought in a fake, you know, programmed banjo roll track or something, and it just sounds robotic. And
yes, it does.
Yeah.
I remember in one session I was doing with Dave Rhodes, the bluegrass band was recording, and Jeremy, my oldest son, was producing for us.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to do some Dobro overdubs like that. Mm-hmm. And I got in there and I was just blundering around, you know. I just couldn't quite get my head into it. And we're sitting there and they said, right, let's just do it bit by bit. And we put them there and I'd say, do you like this? And they said, yeah, that wasn't bad. Do that again. Yeah, right. Try it up higher. Try it lower, you know. And bit by bit we put down some stuff. They were very understanding and wheedled out of me something that sounded tolerable, you know.
Yep.
Yeah, so that was good fun working with them.
Awesome.
Yeah. Another thing that I wanted to ask is, when you're working on a track, do you try and do it as quickly as possible, or do you sort of get it down and then let it sit for a while and then come back to it anew to see if there's anything you need?
I definitely don't try to rush tracks. And I'm at the way I sort of run things at the moment, I'm working on a few things at a time, which there's a fine line of working on too much, but it's good having a bunch of things because then you can step away and work on something different, because sometimes if you work on the same thing for too long, you get this sort of fatigue on it and you...
Yes.
And you, and also you could go the other way. If you spend too long on a track, things that should be fixed end up sounding normal to you. So you work on it, you hear something so many times, you think it's how it is.
Wow.
And then I show other people and they go, oh, this thing pokes out at me. And then I go, oh, it does too. I just got so used to that thing, which is usually a mistake or something that needs to be fixed. And you get used to it. So I think it is good to step away but also not spend too long on a song.
When we got near the final mix, we often asked the recording engineer to play it back through little speakers, we were listening on in those days, a transistor radio, or just, you know, a fairly crappy sort of record player or something like that, instead of the beautiful stereo stuff in the studio, just so we could hear it at low volume and what it sounded like and if it came out. And suddenly you hear it at low volume and you think, there's no bass anymore, you know. Or all we can hear is the bass. You know, what happened to the other things? You know.
Yep. Yeah. Well, that's the last thing I do with a song before I sign it off as done, is I pull out my phone and listen to it on my phone speakers. Yeah. Because sad reality is a lot of people are going to be hearing your song when you release it. They're going to just listen on their phone. They're not going to go, oh, I better go plug this into my hi-fi stereo.
Yeah.
So it's sad, but a lot of people are going to just be scrolling and go, here's a song.
Isn't it?
So you've got to actually make sure it sounds good everywhere. And that's been done for years, and a lot of studios have little lo-fi speakers set up just for that, so they can have a listen to it.
Yes.
Lo-fi, and also listen to it in mono, see how it sounds good down the middle.
Yes.
And they do all those checks. I do the car check is a big one. It's got to sound good in the car stereo.
Oh, is that right?
So I listen to it on as many things, and I tell my clients to do the same. Listen to it on headphones, listen to it in your car, because things will pop, things with different speakers with different frequency responses will poke different things out. And,
Oh, fantastic. Now, what I want to do is play a track from a band called Seldom Seen. Mm. And some of the music, these guys formed in Washington, D.C. in the early 1970s, and some of the musicians were from other bands who had been recording bands and experienced. The lead singer, a mandolin player, had been a prime mover in bluegrass music in Washington and around that area for many, many years. And one of the lead vocalists was new to recording, you know, and he was just a nice singer. He was a doctor and he just played guitar and had a beautiful voice, and they were a real mixture. But their approach to the music suddenly appeared to be different from all the other bands.
Oh, yeah.
And they had a lot of space in their music. And I'm going to play a track. It's time for a gospel song. I always have a gospel song on Back Porch Bluegrass. And so I'm going to play from Act One, first album of the Seldom Seen, a tune called Will There Be Any Stars in My Crown? And see what you think of this.
Will there be any stars in my crown? Shall reach when life's sun goeth down, when through one
wonderful grace, by my Savior I stand. Will there be any stars in my crown?
Will there be any stars, any stars in my crown? When at evening the sun goes down, will I wake with the blessed in God's mansions of rest? Will there be any stars in my crown?
Strength of the Lord, let me labor and pray. Let me watch as a winner of souls, that bright stars may be mine on that glorious day when His praise, like the sea billows, roll.
Will there be stars, any stars in my crown? When at evening the sun goes down, when I wake with the blessed in God's mansions of rest, will there be any stars in
Would you have liked to have recorded that?
Yeah. Yeah, the vocals are beautiful. There's when he hits that high note.
Oh, John Duffy was absolutely amazing. He's sort of extreme in lots of ways, and he's noted as being extreme. But he was a very, very good singer and capable of absolute control and tone and emotion and the whole bit, you know. And interesting, the bass player was a real walker. And it fitted in. And the dobro, that was Mike Aldridge, and very spacey. And you could just about hear the different reverbs on things, couldn't you?
You could. Yeah. It's very a wide stereo field.
Oh, yes, yeah, very much. I mean, every track on the album is a bit like that. And it's just really, really quite special. Something I was going to ask you. Oh, what I'm going to do is play to you, we've got about 10 minutes left, a track which is probably classic mid-50s bluegrass music, and this is sort of what it grew into. This is after the music's only been around about 10 years, right? And it had the format was almost standard, and this was an album we got, and it was the first album that I ever got that actually had what you'd call a standard format of bluegrass music in it. And it's a guy called Earl Taylor, and his the album's incorrectly labeled because the bluegrass musicians are a difficult bunch of people, and evidently the mandolin player and the tenor singer and the guitarist, they sang, were great together, but they frequently argued, and the band broke up often, but then they'd get back together again, and it changed. So the recording company changed the name of the band on them. It's really Earl Taylor, Jim McCall, and the Stony Mountain Boys. And it's absolute classic bluegrass music, and it's one of the songs that every jam session knows, called Cabin Home on the Hill. And this has got just about what I'd call standard bluegrass everything in it, and it's a really interesting mix, and I think you'll enjoy it. I'll just get myself set up over here. What are we? Yeah, we're all set to go. Mm-hmm.
my dear. It seems there's a longing for you still. Now all I have to do now is sit alone and cry in our little cabin home on the hill. Oh, someone has taken you from me and left me here all alone. Just listen to the rain beat on my window pane in our little cabin home on the hill. For you still. Now I'll just keep you there so I won't be alone in our little cabin home on the hill. Oh, someone has taken you from me and left me here all alone. Just listen to the rain beat on my window pane in our little cabin home on the hill. And find there's no more happiness for you. Just let your thoughts turn back once more, if you will, to our little cabin home on the hill. Oh, someone have taken you from me and left me here all alone. Just listen to the rain beat on my window pane in our little cabin home on the hill.
Absolutely, sort of, I suppose you'd say bog standard bluegrass.
Yeah.
They had a band sound. They recorded 12 tracks in a 4-hour session. They just went into the studio, laid down the tracks, and went home, you know. And that was it. And they just mixed everything the way it played. Once again, the banjo player wasn't a singer, so he played right through everything, you know, all that.
Yeah, wow.
Good. Anyway, lots of things going on. Have you got a lot of work lined up?
Yeah, fair bit. Yeah.
what sort of thing? All once again, just singles and.
Yeah. No? I'm working on 2 albums. One's almost finished from a local duo called Rowdy's Rose from Te Awa Muru.
Yes.
Another album I just started with someone, and then just a whole bunch of singles.
Wow. Do you have time for your own music amongst all this?
A little bit. I released a song a couple of months ago.
Yeah.
I have a few songs in the barrel that are written, but I just sort of try to work on them when I have any gaps, which is not a lot at the moment.
No.
But my main focus is the producing thing. I'm happy to chuck in my own song every now and again, but I'm focusing on the studio at the moment. So.
Right. How many people can you get into your studio at a time? Would you record a duo? I mean, it's a pretty small room. It's like this studio at Free FM. You'd record, you know, 2 guitar, 2 voice duo at the same time.
Yeah, I would, and I've done that with a duo. But I usually there's still a lot of overdubbing to be done. Yeah. So I use the duo. The duo comes in and they would do their scratch tracks. We call them were tracks that when they're there as a guide and they're going to be deleted later on once they're. The real things are put on.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's mainly overdubbing at this stage.
Yes, okay. Yeah. What's your next piece of equipment?
Oh, the list is long.
Oh, is it really?
And it's about deciding which one is needed the most. The wish list is long. I really would like a ribbon mic. There's a certain, called the Royer. R121. It's a famous ribbon mic. It's great for electric guitar amps.
Okay.
Paired with a Shure SM57. It's like the sort of golden combo. So that's And it's on the wish list.
You put the two mics there and then merge the sounds.
Yeah, so you put them so they're picking up the same at the picking up the sound at the exact same time. They've got to be in the right spot, otherwise you get some weird phasing issues.
Yes,
but yeah, you blend them together. One has a more direct attack sound because it's a dynamic microphone, and one that's condensed, a ribbon, so it has more of a sort of a rounded low-end sound, and they mix together and you get
so
a really nice...
So what do you use on the electric guitar amp now?
I use the 57 Solder. Isn't that amazing? And I also use it in conjunction with another ribbon mic. It's not the same ribbon mic, but it's another one here.
Okay, but those sort of things come after you've paid the rates and the repair bill on the car. And,
that's the one.
And,
that's the one.
Yeah. Yes, your wife might have to get three jobs instead of just two jobs to support your recording industry.
Yeah. Luckily, I also teach full-time. That's my main job. And
Teach guitar mostly?
I teach guitar, a little bit of bass, ukulele, and I take a couple of school rock bands as well.
Oh, yes, so. Like Sam did. Oh,
yeah, I did,
Oh, very good. Well, we're just about at the end of the show. Thanks very much for coming in. Dan, I've really enjoyed talking to you. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And I'm going to play you a track that you might like called The Huckleberry Hornpipe from Dan Carey.
Awesome.
You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
This is Bird Note. Helmeted guinea fowl are sometimes kept as ornamental birds in zoos and farmyards around the world. But from Senegal to South Africa, where the birds are native, their raucous calls are a familiar sound. Helmeted guinea fowl are chicken-sized birds whose round black bodies are covered in tiny white speckles. In stark contrast, their heads are bald, blue, and adorned with a keratinous horn-like helmet on top. They're known for running about in social flocks, squawking as they go, perpetually panic-stricken about something. These are calls of alarm, warning all members of the flock that a predator approaches. In their native range, guinea fowl are favored prey of wildcats and martial eagles. Because they're also spooked by unfamiliar people, guinea fowl are often employed as burglar alarms on farms. Guinea fowl are related to chickens and pheasants, and like them, they lay a lot of eggs, up to a dozen in a nest. The chicks are cute balls of fluff that rapidly grow into gawky juveniles. Helmeted guinea fowl are easily domesticated, but they'll always remain flighty, squawky, birds in a panic. for Bird Note. I'm Michael Stein.
You're listening.